Greetings and seasonal merrimentations, my portmentated listeners, and welcome to this December 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this Christmas podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Happy Christmas, and may you all get pre-Boxing Day boxers. All I want for Christmas is for the Star Wars series to end on a high note and not being told that Rey's father is Jabba the Hutt or something. Anyway. You may notice that my voice is not quite up to snuff. This is because I've now gotten the second cold in a row, which I don't quite understand how I can have such lousy luck. Yes, it is possible to have two colds in a row. You can have multiple colds in a row. The bad luck comes with having two different viruses. The first cold you're usually resistant to after you get it. The second, you wouldn't be resistant if it was a completely different virus. Lucky me. Anyway, my first present of the evening to you guys is a pair of gentlemen who deserve Idiot Scientists of the Month. And perhaps the coveted General Idiots of the Month, or perhaps Idiots of the Year. Friday, November 15th, two chemistry professors at Henderson State University in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, were arrested after being accused of making methamphetamine in a university laboratory, according to the Washington Post. Associate professors Dr. Terry David Bateman and Dr. Bradley Allen Rowland have been on administrative leave since October 11th, following an investigation into reports of a chemical odor in the university science center. Now, before I go on, I have to say, look, how strange is it that chemical odors are coming from chemistry labs? I can't imagine what those chemical smells might be. Seriously, that's why someone decided to start an investigation? It's like walking to a restaurant and complaining of strange cooking smells. I smell something suspicious back there in the kitchen. Perhaps that's veal. I don't know. It's just strange. So, chemical testing showed elevated levels of benzyl chloride, a chemical that can be used to make meth in a chemical laboratory. The building was immediately closed for cleanup and reopened October 29th, according to the Post. Okay, I don't entirely understand that either. Cleanup? I don't get that. Again, these are chemical labs. Were these guys such horrid, horrid chemists that they had some sort of toxic spill with their little Breaking Bad homage? I don't get it. Just how bad are these guys? Tina Hall, the Associate Vice President of Marketing and Communications at Henderson, says, "The safety of our students, faculty, and staff is a top priority, and we continue to cooperate with authorities." The good Dr. Bateman, Director of Undergraduate Research in the Chemistry Department, has been with the university for a decade, while Dr. Rowland joined in 2014. The two face charges of manufacturing methamphetamine, a felony that could mean up to 40 years in prison, and using drug paraphernalia, which carries a possible 20-year sentence. So here's a bonus Idiot Scientist story as my Christmas present to you. The nonprofit online news source ProPublica has collected more than 29,000 disclosures of faculty members with outside incomes that they get in addition to their regular salaries. Now, why is that a problem? Well, folks, these scientists are not moonlighting at the 7-Eleven. We're talking conflict of interest. Over the past year, ProPublica has sought to highlight the potential conflicts of interests defined as professional relationships that might influence research, teaching, and other activities of faculty members at public universities and research institutions. And they have created a database of professors' corporate and nonprofit funding. The publication requested outside income forms for faculty from at least one public university in each U.S. state. Fewer than two dozen responded, and some of those responses were incomplete. Ha! Sounds like they were dealing with the Ukraine. Anyway, from private universities, the ProPublica team gathered disclosures from papers and federal grants. Finally, the National Institutes of Health shared its database with ProPublica. Why are conflicts of interest a problem? Well, financial conflicts of interest influence outcomes of studies. Even if the researchers are honorable people, they don't know how the interests affect their own research. In other words, it poisons the well or biases the system. In short, it perverts science. Although many universities have improved their internal reporting requirements for such conflicts, the whole of academia does not have consistent guidelines for those disclosures to be shared, with transparency rules that vary among universities and states. With the initial launch of ProPublica's Dollars for Profs database, the nonprofit collected 29,000 records from academic institutions and 8,100 records from the NIH. These records are now all cataloged and searchable on their website. Go for it. If you think a PI you know is profiting when they shouldn't be, you'll be able to find out. Okay, first regular story of the night came at the suggestion of listener Lior Sar. Sorry if my pronunciation of your name is seriously way off. Lior came across a physics story that he found a bit puzzling and intriguing, and he's certainly not the only one. This next story has puzzled and intrigued some pretty great minds out there. And what's the question? Well, is there a fifth physics force in nature that has something to do with dark matter, and is there clear evidence for it?
Oh man, we're back to dark matter again. Dude, are you like completely obsessed with dark matter?
Well, no. But if it impacts on the existence of a fifth force, that's interesting. Of course, at the moment, it is controversial whether a fifth force and or dark matter exist. So, to review. Physics centers essentially on four forces that control our known visible universe, governing everything from the production of heat in the sun to the way your laptop works. They are gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. New research may show evidence of that mysterious fifth force. The research work was led by Dr. Attila Krasnow-Orki of CERN and was just made public last month in the Harvard Scientific Online Archive and posted. However, yes, it has technically still not been peer-reviewed or even technically actually published yet. Krasnow-Orki and company were closely observing how an excited helium atom emitted light as it decayed. The particles split at an unusual angle, 150 degrees. Now I read that and I shrug. It seemed like a seriously so-what moment. However, Krasnow-Orki and company say that that angle of emission can't be explained by known physics. Krasnow-Orki stated publicly, quote, "This was the second time we detected a new particle, which we are calling X17, because we have calculated its mass to be 17 mega electron volts." Unquote. Fair enough. Krasnow-Orki has referred to this unseen fifth force in action as what he calls a protophobic force, meaning that it was as though these particles were afraid of protons and wouldn't come into contact with them. Lots of researchers immediately started speculating what X17 may be. Some have concluded that if it exists, it could be a particle which connects our visible world to that of the dark matter world. If any of this stuff can be reproduced by other labs, it could change physics as we know it, or it could be just a simple lab error. Some very famous physicists have apparently literally been going back and examining every other experiment that's been done in the history of physics to explain why this X17 particle has never been detected before, along with the undetected fifth force. Frankly, I have no idea whether any of this is true or not. I'm not a physicist. All I can figure is that if there was no experimental error in the setup, then you really can't argue with the end result. You can argue with the interpretation, but as I always tell my students, the data is the data. As long as you didn't make a mistake, it's your responsibility to explain and interpret what you found. If it is consistent, weird as the data may be, well, then it's pretty much set in stone. There you go. The next story is a weird one, which to me borders between idiocy and genius. What do I mean? Well, Drs. Yaniv Ehrlich, who is now the CSO of the company MyHeritage, and Dr. Robert Grass of ETH Zurich have composed DNA to carry the instructions for 3D printing of all things, a plastic rabbit. This work was published December 9th in the journal Nature Biotechnology. which is pretty impressive by itself. Then the really impressive feat is that they have taken the idea of DNA storage a step further than anyone else has by embedding silica beads with that genetic blueprint into the plastic bunny. Ehrlich and Grass have recreated 5 generations of the rabbit by using a sample of DNA from each iteration to print a new rabbit with high fidelity. The printing instructions are stored in 45 kilobases of DNA, which is packaged into beads that are just a nanometer in diameter. The beads were then added to the 3D printing material so that the object would carry the instructions for its own creation. They repeated the exercise on a larger scale, coding a movie into DNA and embedding the genetic storage into plexiglass. They then took a fragment of the plexiglass and sequencing the DNA allowed them to recreate the video. In the paper, Ehrlich suggests, quote, "This may be a new approach to store electronic health records and implants, produce self-replicating machines, or just hide data. The printed object will look like an ordinary object, so it's a very effective way of hiding information," unquote. I have seen pictures of the plastic rabbit, and it looks like a white plastic rabbit. Nothing special that I couldn't print on my own 3D setup. But it's not that the bunny that is special. The amazing concept is the idea of embedding hidden information in an object. If you can hide that DNA code in anything, including a plastic window, it may create the ultimate security for secret data. Think about it. It's like the purloined letter. Who has the time or energy to go checking every plastic object in the world for concealed DNA code? Next story. I like to tell my biology classes that life can be found pretty much everywhere on Earth, from the crushing depths of the ocean to the frozen tops of the highest mountains, from the sub-zero Antarctic Ocean to the hyper-heated volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean. And we can find life pretty much anywhere. Well, it turns out there are limits to that statement. Some researchers have found that some places on Earth really have no life at all. Dr. Purificacion López-García of the French National Center for Scientific Research, has published an article in Nature Ecology and Evolution that has confirmed the absence of microbial life in hot, saline, hyperacidic ponds in the Dalal geothermal field in Ethiopia. The infertile landscape of Dalal, located in the Ethiopian depression of Nanakil, extends over a volcanic crater full of salt, where toxic gases emanate and water boils in the midst of intense hydrothermal activity. It's one of the most torrid and horrid environments on Earth. Temperatures there in the winter can still exceed 45 degrees Celsius in the winter, and there are abundant hypersaline and hyperacidic pools with pH values that are so low they actually are in the negative. López-García states, quote, "After analyzing so many more samples than in previous works with adequate controls so as not to contaminate them and a well-calibrated methodology, we have verified that there's no microbial life in these salty, hot, hyperacid pools or in the adjacent magnesium-rich brine lakes. Although we have found a great diversity of primitive salt-loving microorganisms in the desert and saline canyons around the hydrothermal site," unquote. According to López-García, this work, quote, "helps to circumscribe the limits of habitability for life," unquote, and it demands caution when interpreting morphological biosignatures on Earth and beyond, and that one should not rely on the apparently cellular or biological aspects of a structure. Just because it looks alive, it could have an abiotic origin. He stresses, quote, "In addition, our study presents evidence that there are places on Earth's surface like the Dalal pools that are sterile even though they contain liquid water. That means that the presence of liquid water on a planet or a moon, which astrobiologists often use as a habitability criteria, does not directly imply that there is life there," unquote. The obvious example here is his own work. Why doesn't anything grow in Dalal? Well, in this case, López-García found 2 physical chemical barriers that prevent the presence of living organisms in those ponds. First, the abundance of chaotropic magnesium salts. Those are a strong agent that breaks hydrogen bonds and denatures biochemicals. And then the second is the confluence of, besides those chaotropic magnesium salts, they are hypersaline, they are hyperacidic, and they are hotter than the blazes. So, too much salt, too much heat, too much acid, and that'll pretty much keep anything from growing. Lopez Garcia finishes with, quote, "We would not expect to find life forms in similar environments on other planets, at least not based on a biochemistry similar to terrestrial biochemistry," unquote. And I have to agree with Dr. Purificacion. It's a good idea to be very prudent with our interpretations before reaching any conclusions in astrobiology. We still have no idea what's out there exactly in the universe. Next story. Do kids with attention deficit disorder necessarily need drugs? Is there an alternative? The answer may surprise you. All right, not really. A study by researchers from China Medical University in Taichung, Taiwan, has found that omega-3 fish oil supplements may have equivalent or even greater beneficial effects on attention deficit in children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder than do conventional drugs, but only among individuals who have otherwise low levels of omega-3 in their blood. The study results indicated that for individuals with already high levels of omega-3 fatty acid, eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, further omega-3 supplementation may have detrimental effects on certain measures of ADHD. The scientists say the study is the first that they know of to report the effects of monotherapy using EPA in individuals with ADHD. The paper was published in the journal Translational Psychiatry last month. Dr. Jade Chang of King's College London led the study and says, quote, "Our results suggest that fish oil supplements are at least as effective for attention deficit disorders as conventional pharmacological methods on those children with ADHD who have omega-3 deficiencies. On the other hand, it is possible to have too much of a good thing, and parents should always consult with their children's psychiatrists, since our study suggests that there could be negative effects for some children," unquote. Omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids have been closely associated with cognitive function and academic performance for a while. To investigate directly whether eicosapentaenoic acid may impact on ADHD, the team carried out a 12-week placebo-controlled trial to evaluate the effects of high-dose eicosapentaenoic acid compared with placebo in 92 children and adolescents aged 6 to 18 years of age who had been referred to the China Medical University Hospital Department of Psychiatry between 2016 and 2017 with a diagnosis of ADHD. All the participants had either never taken ADHD drugs or had received no medication for at least the previous 6 months. The main outcome of the trial were focused attention, impulsivity, sustained attention, and vigilance, as assessed by something called the Continuous Performance Test. Secondary measures were assessed using additional recognized scoring systems. Blood levels of polyunsaturated fats were measured at baseline and at the end of the trial. The trial results confirmed the children with the lowest baseline blood levels of eicosapentaenoic acid showed improvements in focused attention and vigilance after taking the omega-3 supplements for 12 weeks. However, these improvements were not seen in children with normal or high baseline blood levels of EPA. In addition, for children with high existing eicosapentaenoic acid levels, omega-3 supplements actually had negative effects on impulsivity control. Why do I even bring up this story at all? Very simple. All too often in Western culture, we are very quick to prescribe drugs for our children that we think may help them when it has to do with their psychological health. Sometimes these drugs help, and sometimes those pharmaceuticals do not help, but we are far too dependent on them for helping children. I'm just presenting the story as evidence that sometimes there is a better way, a way that does not necessarily involve altering our children with the help of Big Pharma. It's just a thought. So finally, the last story of the night, which is a kind of holiday nutrition story, which also kind of goes along with the last one, sort of. So this is about a paper entitled The Depressogenic Potential of Added Dietary Sugars. And it's from the journal Medical Hypotheses, and it's going to be published this January. And the paper suggests that winter indulgence of a sweet tooth may not be such a great idea because it will make you even more depressed if you are not already teetering on the edge. In short, anybody prone to depression may do well to steer clear of sugar-laden figgy puddings, sweets, and treats over the holiday season. You may think it's helping you at the time, but just like an alcoholic with alcohol, it's not going to be really helping you in the longer run. Clinical psychologists at the University of Kansas analyzed a wide range of research on the physiological and psychological effects of eating foods with added sugar. The results supported the hypothesis that consuming foods containing a lot of added sugar, which are hard to avoid, frankly, this time of year, can trigger metabolic, inflammatory, and neurobiological processes that are all tied to depressive illness. The lead author, Dr. Stephen Ilardi, says, quote, "When we consume sweets, they act like a drug. They have an immediate mood-elevating effect. But in high doses, they can have a paradoxical, pernicious, longer-term consequence of making mood worse, reducing well-being, elevating inflammation, and causing weight gain," unquote. Sugar has become a dietary staple throughout the developed world, the authors write. And people in the U.S. currently derive an estimated 14% of all their calories from added sugars that are typically introduced into foods and beverages during processing. And this amounts to what Ilardi says is, quote, "the equivalent of 18 extra teaspoons worth of sugar each day," unquote. The paper says that these sweeteners are even found in an estimated 75% of all packaged food. A high sugar diet is believed to represent a risk factor for disorders, including cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, as well as obesity. And as a result, U.S. dietary guidelines now advise limiting the consumption of added sugars, both to promote better overall health and to help reduce the burgeoning toll of obesity. It's been found that when people improve their diets to boost nutrition or lose weight, they can also reduce the symptoms of depression, the authors comment. Ilardi says, quote, "Moreover, healthy and unhealthy diets, respectively, each appear to exert independent effects on mental health, which suggests that depressogenic processes can be affected both by the relative absence of key nutrients and by the excessive presence of harmful food," unquote. Coupled diet with dwindling light in the wintertime and corresponding changes in sleep patterns, it is possible that high sugar consumption could result in a perfect storm that adversely affects mental health, the researchers reasoned. Ilardi says, "For many people, reduced sunlight exposure during the winter will throw off circadian rhythms, disrupt healthy sleep, and push 5-10% of the population into a full-blown episode of clinical depression," unquote. The researchers acknowledge that while the hypothesized link between depression and added dietary sugar is neither definitive nor conclusive, because, quote, "more rigorous experimental manipulations of added sugar intake need to be performed, as well as examination of larger numbers of people." However, the evidence to date is still, quote unquote, "persuasive," they say. Lardy finishes the paper with a caution that it might be appropriate to view added sugar at high enough levels as physically and psychologically harmful, akin to drinking a little too much alcohol, like I mentioned earlier. He finishes with, quote, "we have pretty good evidence that one alcoholic drink a day is safe, and it might have a beneficial effect for some people. Alcohol is basically pure calories, pure energy, non-nutritive, and super toxic at high doses. Sugars are pretty similar. We're learning when it comes to depression, people who optimize their diet should provide all the nutrients the brain needs and mostly avoid potential toxins," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. Try fish oil. Maybe that'll help with depression if the sweets don't. Don't take that second job at Monsanto if you're already a PI. Don't trust plastic rabbits for keeping your secrets. Keep watching the skies for anything that can live in a hot, salty, acidic environment. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.